The Guardian.
Nuclear war is a possibility most people prefer not to contemplate.
Today, we live in the shadow of a monstrous, writhing cloud of mushroom-like shapes. Gradually, our minds began to accept the problems created by this new horror.
Nuclear fission power, in which energy is released by splitting heavy atoms, is a proven technology available today. And beyond any possible doubt, it's here to stay.
Last month, the UK government announced that it's beginning its journey towards a net zero carbon economy by 2050. How the UK will do this is yet to be decided, but many think nuclear power will play an important role. However, the technology has remained controversial for decades. This week, I want to unpick why we're so radiophobic.
So actually, it is one of the safest energy technologies that we have.
People have very rational fears. Now, they're not always justified when you get the Geiger counters out and measure things, but they are rational fears. And the trouble with the word is it gets used by the nuclear industry to excuse themselves.
And if the government wants to steam ahead with fission technology, how can it change nuclear's image? I'm Ian Sample. This is Science Weekly.
So at the moment, the way that we produce energy actually has changed quite a bit over...
To get a handle on where the UK stands on energy supply today, I spoke to Professor Martin Freer. He's the director of the Birmingham Energy Institute.
So we have broadly about 20% nuclear power, broadly another 20% of renewables, and then a very large fraction of our energy generation comes from gas. And that largely is imported gas, but there is also a small component of residual coal generation. And that's the thing that's really has changed over the last 5 to 10 years, is the amount of power which has been generated by coal.
And does this mix need to change, in your opinion?
Well, what we've done so far is good, but it's clearly only half of the journey, because gas is, although it's cleaner than coal, is still polluting from a carbon dioxide perspective. We do need, if we are to meet our carbon targets, to further reduce gas, and that's gas generation, and also the emissions from gas, which one can think about in terms of capturing the carbon dioxide in what's known as carbon capture and storage.
Coming back to nuclear, how big a role do you think it will have to play?
So a few years ago, the government set a path which was to establish broadly something like 40% of our electricity generation by wind. And actually, over the last few years, enormous progress has been made in that direction. And a further 40% was to come from nuclear power. And the remainder, which is about 20%, would be from gas generation. So you can see from that, and I don't think things have changed substantially since, that we need, in terms of electricity, about 40% nuclear. So it is going to be a major component of our energy economy.
However, there is some opposition to nuclear power. The most recent poll suggests that only 40% of the British public are in favour of nuclear energy. But when nuclear power was first harnessed, there was a huge amount of excitement about what this new technology could enable.
Fred Pearce, I'm a freelance environment author and journalist.
Fred has been writing about the environment for over 20 years, including for The Guardian. He's just written a book called Fallout, A Journey Through the Nuclear Age, from the atom bomb to radioactive waste.
It was a huge jump. If you're used to just getting your energy from burning coal, and you're suddenly told that this atom can generate all the energy you want, which is how people saw it.
We invited him in to talk about our ideas and perceptions surrounding nuclear and how they've radically changed over the last 70 years.
Well, quite a lot of things played out after that.
As the public came to know about nuclear, how was it perceived? I mean, were people at the start disturbed by it, or was there actually a real excitement about this new technology?
There was real excitement. So in America, sort of football clubs named themselves the sort of atomic team. There were Miss Atomic America contests being held initially in Las Vegas, which was just down the road from one of the testing sites. And of course, the bikini. They invented a two-piece swimsuit and they named it after the place where they were testing atomic weapons. I mean, this is a very strange time. I mean, there were fears. There was a real fear, is this going to be the end of the world? What exactly was going to happen here? But there was also a kind of almost sort of love affair with this new technology. And that played out not just in bombs, but also in nuclear power, with people talking about having energy that would be too cheap to meter.
What happened to turn the tide against nuclear? Was it the bombings in Japan, or was it events after that?
I think it was the events after that. The Japanese almost decided to forget about Hiroshima and Nagasaki, that it was a horrible event, but it was tied up with their loss of the war. And they sort of put it to one side, and it was only later, and probably only most dramatically after the Fukushima accident just 7 years ago, that their sense of loathing of atomic energy really got going.
Flesh that out a little bit more for us. What have you seen change there as a result of what happened at Fukushima?
The Japanese embracing of nuclear technology is just, if you like, part of the modern world, has really evaporated very fast. I spent several weeks in Japan talking about these issues, and most people said to me, well, before we thought it was fine, it was generating our energy, that was fine. It's flipped really to a horror and a huge distrust of their own government. After that accident, for 10 days, no government gave out any data. The company didn't give out any data of how much radiation was in the air. Tens of thousands of people were being evacuated. They were fleeing. Nobody told them if they were going to die tomorrow. And that, I mean, in fact, they weren't. The radiation levels weren't so high, really. But the fear has really taken hold. So Japan had about 50 power reactors operating there, and most were shut down, and they're now trying to start them up again. But most local authorities won't have it. Most of them, the great majority, are still shut, and I think that's likely to remain the case.
Having looked across all these different incidents that have happened over the decades with nuclear, how would you characterize how governments and the industry has responded in the heat of those moments?
With lies and deceit, really, too often, especially in the days after things went wrong. So the nuclear industry talks quite a lot about, they talk about radiophobia, they talk about how the public has an irrational fear of things, of radiation. But there's something psychological on the other side, a sort of inbred secrecy, reluctance to tell the world anything. It's understandable. It arises because, the toxic legacy of nuclear power arising out of nuclear bomb making. So there were traditions of secrecy. And I think, that's a bad mix, especially in an environment today where we're inherently skeptical of authority figures.
You mentioned in the book that this phrase, radiophobia, is actually pretty unfair on the people it's often used to describe, because those people, in some cases, have directly experienced the uncertainty and the real fear that comes with not knowing if the cloud going overhead is lethal or not. And we know from some past incidents that sometimes those clouds are lethal, from what happened with Japanese fishermen during some of the nuclear bomb tests and such like.
People have very rational fears. Now, they're not always justified when you get the Geiger counters out and measure things, but there are rational fears about something which is very difficult for you to get your head around. If somebody tells you a nuclear power plant down the road is blowing up and you can see it blowing up, you have no idea how much radiation is coming at you. So it's a bit rich to accuse people who got frightened of being sort of radiophobic. And the trouble with the word is it gets used by the nuclear industry to excuse themselves. They will say, well, there was not much radiation, so you were all just being a bit silly, weren't you? For me, radiophobia and the long-term things, I mean, most of the health consequences of Chernobyl really have been about psychological impacts and suicides and long-term effects in society, which are not really connected with radiation. But you can't say those are not consequences of nuclear accidents. They're absolutely consequences of nuclear accidents.
After Chernobyl, there was no communication about what was happening. Indeed, it was only after higher levels of radioactivity were detected in Sweden that the Soviet Union was finally forced to admit there had been an accident, 3 days after the explosion. On the 28th of April 1986, a news program called Vremya read the following statement.
There has been an accident at the Chernobyl nuclear power plant. One of the nuclear reactors was damaged. The effects of the accident are being remedied. Assistance has been provided for any affected people. An investigative commission has been set up.
That was all the information broadcast. And remember, the internet wasn't around in 1986, and so nobody knew what to do or what the risks were. It's this lack of information that led to a lot of distrust in the community. It's something that happened in Japan after the Fukushima accident too.
I don't know what the consequences of radiation exposure will be, as I'm not an expert. But the government's word is no immediate danger to health, which I don't believe.
Yoshimi lived within an hour's drive of Fukushima. He was evacuated after the accident, but was later told he could return. However, when he spoke to The Guardian in 2014, he didn't believe it was safe.
The bottom line is, the government can't be trusted.
But how safe are they? And how do they compare to, say, wind power or coal power?
A properly running nuclear plant has very few risks. And even bad accidents don't kill that many people. You can, I wouldn't necessarily make the case, but you could make the case that Chernobyl really only killed 28 people who were clambering all over the roofs trying to put out the fire at the time of the accident. I think probably there were some more deaths, particularly thyroid cancers and that kind of thing. But there, I think it's pretty clear now, more than 30 years on, that it didn't kill the sort of tens of thousands of people that some people feared at the time.
And if one tries to put it in context against coal power or gas power or even wind power, the number of deaths per kilowatt hour, so amount of electricity generated for all of the technologies such as coal, gas, wind, is higher than the nuclear power. So actually it is one of the safest energy technologies that we have. And indeed, if one looks at future generation nuclear power stations, so there's a variety of new nuclear power stations, so the EPR reactor, which is being built at Hinkley Point C. These have even further enhanced safety. So, if possible, nuclear power will become even more safe in the future.
After the break, we'll be speaking with a cognitive neuroscientist about how the government could give nuclear a much-needed makeover.
I think when it comes to nuclear, it's more than just a science.
I'll be back in a moment.
Hi, Lucy Lamble here. In our latest episode of our Global Development podcast, Small Changes, I speak to Leah Chibet-Zia.
For the girls who are at the age of 12, 13 and up to 17, in Pokot kind of environment, these girls go for a female genital mutilation and they stay in a seclusion for about 3 months. And after 3 months, they are married off.
Leah is a women's rights activist in Kenya, who through her work at the Pokot Women's Empowerment Organisation is a champion for eradicating the ceremonial practice of female genital mutilation and getting young girls back to school.
Girls are supposed to stay at home and help domestic work at home, but then the boys are allowed to go to school.
To have a listen, head over to theguardian.com/podcasts or search Small Changes on your favourite podcast app.
Welcome back to Science Weekly. I'm Ian Sample. Before the break, we delved into the perceptions of nuclear energy and whether the perceived risk from nuclear is matched with the actual risk. Both Fred and Martin thought not. Nuclear is in fact very safe when compared with other energy sources like wind and coal. But if the government continues with Hinkley Point and other nuclear reactors, what does it need to do to get the public on side? Is there any way trust in nuclear can be rebuilt?
Hi, this is Tally.
Hi, Tally. This is Ian Sample at The Guardian here. I don't know if you can hear our producer as well. Tally Sharrett is a cognitive neuroscientist at UCL and has just written a book about how understanding the brain can help us be more open to changing our minds about something. It's called The Influential Mind. I wanted to get to grips with how we make a decision about information. When do we disregard it, and when do we take it in and change our mind?
Encounter new information. And the real question is, how much are you going to update your beliefs when you encounter that new piece of evidence? And that really depends on four factors. One is, what is your current belief? The second is, what is your confidence in your current belief? The third is, what is a new piece of evidence? And the fourth is your confidence in that new piece of evidence. And the further away that new piece of evidence is from your current belief, the less likely you are to change your beliefs. And that's not an irrational way to go about it, because normally when you hear something that really doesn't fit what your belief is, on average, that piece of information will in fact be false. So for example, if I were to tell you that I saw a pink elephant flying in the sky, you would assume that I'm delusional or lying, as you should. And so it makes sense for the brain to assess a new piece of evidence in light of the knowledge that it already stores. But the problem is that that also means that it's really difficult to change people's beliefs when those beliefs are quite strong, but are also false.
When we're talking about nuclear issues, about nuclear energy and such like, the different kinds of voices that you can hear tend to be governments, you know, the nuclear industry, scientists, doctors and so on, and obviously people who are directly affected, people living around those kinds of places. How good are we at deciding which voices to listen to and which ones not to listen to when we are hearing new information about sort of existing beliefs?
Well, we find that in many issues, people will just listen to the people who are around them and not necessarily to the expert. I think when it comes to nuclear, it's more than just a science. And so it's not very surprising that on topics like that, as well as topics like climate change and so on, it's not just a science that matters, because people have worldviews that come into play when they form beliefs about these type of issues.
Do you think this has always been the way, that people have always listened to those closest to them more than others who may actually be more expert? Or is this something that has changed in recent years with this sort of idea, this meme of the ditching of the expert?
I think the rules by which we seek out information and change our beliefs have not changed. Our brain is pretty much the same, and the psychology is very, very similar. You know, back in the day, when, you know, to get medical advice, yes, you'd go to the doctor, but people also listen to their mother and so on. So I don't think it's new. What's new nowadays is that we have so much information available to us just by the click of the mouse, and so many opinions. And so it's extremely easy to go online and find the evidence that you want to find. And I think that's what the difference is today versus, you know, even 10 or 20 years ago. And also, it's a little bit more difficult to distinguish between the experts and the non-experts. It's difficult to distinguish between who just, you know, saying whatever they want based on nothing at all and who actually has data behind them.
You can see with social media how we can all end up in sort of information bubbles, where I may read information that is, I would say, is being, you know, giving the scientific evidence for nuclear energy and nuclear waste and things like that. And other people may, you know, be in entirely different bubbles. And I'm wondering, when you have a situation like that with people almost being sort of siloed in the information they're getting, how do you change their minds, or how, you know, can they understand more information if they want to change their minds?
So if we look back to a few of the things that we talked about, first of all, we said that people are more likely to believe people who are like them on some kind of dimension. So if the information is coming from a source that is like the recipient in some kind of way,
It could be political, but it could be something like one mother to another. People are more likely to listen. The second thing is that we find that whenever someone agrees with you, you're more likely to pay attention. So the lesson from this is that we really should start by something that we have in common, something that we agree on. Can we start with something we agree on? Then the person is more likely to listen to whatever comes next. I can give you an example from the controversy on autism and vaccines. So there are parents who decide not to vaccinate their kids because of the alleged link to autism. And the normal approach of the medical community is to give them data and figures that shows actually there's no link between autism and childhood vaccines. And that doesn't seem to work very well because they already have their strong opinion. But then they thought, well, can we get to the same outcome to have parents actually decide to vaccinate their kids without focusing on what we disagree on, but focus on what we agree on? And so what they did is they highlighted how these vaccines are protecting kids from potentially deadly diseases, the mumps, rubella, measles. And by doing that and not focusing on the link to autism, not focusing on what they disagree on, they were much more likely to change the intentions of the parents to vaccinate their kids.
So it's all about reframing the message, admitting that nuclear has a past legacy of accidents, deceit, and lies, but also highlighting why nuclear can be a good option. Tally's research seems to suggest that, like telling mothers that their child will be safe from measles if they have the MMR jab, framing nuclear as a technology that will help reduce the effects of climate change or create thousands of new jobs could help change attitudes. But given that only 40% of Britons are in favour of nuclear power, should we be steaming ahead with the technology? Should we wait and see if the tide of opinion turns once more? Martin argues that nuclear faces similar problems to all energy sectors, be they wind turbines ruining Britain's rolling landscapes or concerns around fracking.
So if one takes wind power, people are not wild about having large-scale wind generation close to where they live. And that has driven wind generation very successfully offshore. And the UK is very lucky to have some shallow waters which allow the deployment of offshore wind, and there's a lot of success in that sector. But then one might also look at the controversy which has come out of fracking and production of shale gas locally. I think when anything new and uncertain happens, people are worried and will react against that. So it doesn't just happen in the nuclear sector that people are uncomfortable about construction and new technologies and new developments. It's a phenomenon which is across the sector.
Just finally, Martin, if I may, is when you look at nuclear around the world, does it look like it's an industry with a great future, or is it actually dwindling, becoming more niche in terms of where it is used, where people still buy into it and exploit it?
Well, it's a very interesting question. I think we sit somewhat at a transition. Certain countries, so one might take China. So China have little choice. They are building hundreds of nuclear power stations, and building that scale allows them then, of course, to embed nuclear technology, but nuclear approaches in their culture. And because I think China is going to be such a powerhouse for the future, they will dictate the energy economies of many countries in 10, 30 years' time. And we will be buying energy technologies from China. And already we are thinking about building and purchasing a nuclear power station from China General Nuclear. So China, I think, is setting the pace. Whatever China does, the rest of the world will follow. And the fact that the UK has been up with the pace up to now is actually a good sign.
Not everyone thinks that nuclear power is inevitable. Fred Pearce has raised concerns about public backing But one thing we haven't had time to discuss is the highly toxic waste that comes from running a plant. The issue of how we deal with that is not going away. Nuclear has its problems, but one thing that strikes me is how sad it is that we haven't been able to exploit this amazing scientific breakthrough in a way that works for everyone. If you've got any questions, queries, or feedback for us, please get in touch via email, scienceweekly@theguardian.com. Thank you to Martin Freer, Fred Pearce, and Tally Sharrett for joining us this week. I'm Ian Sample. This is Science Weekly.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.